Good morning, friends. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Thursday, March 17th. Also the day the field of 64 kicks off in the NCAA tournament. Not that I really pay attention, but I have to keep you guys up to date. I know you demand it. It's not too late to enter the Bracketology with Father Bronner contest. Sitting here holding in my hands. Hopefully you can hear the crinkle of the cellophane on the air. It's a Chick-fil-A wrapped gift basket for the winner of our Bracketology with Father Bronner contest. I'm just sitting here looking at, there's a card here for, oh, a free, two free entrees, a free small catering tray. Let's see, a couple of free meals, a couple of free milkshakes, a couple of free breakfasts. Pretty good. Also, a stuffed cow with an Eat More Chicken sign on it. I mean, like a stuffed animal cow, not an actual stuffed cow. That'd be a little big for a basket. And we've got a T-shirt, Chick-fil-A T-shirt, glasses, poster. Oh, man, it's right there for the winner of our 7th annual Bracketology with Father Bronner contest. All you got to do is go to the show's Facebook page, MikeAllenShow.blogspot.com. You've got till noon today. Go in there and follow the links on how you can go online. If you have never registered, you got to create a user ID and a password. You know how that goes. And then you got to look for the contest, Bracketology with Father Bronner, and the password is Father Bronner. No space between. All that information's on the show's blog, MikeAllenShow.blogspot.com. Everybody who surpasses our prognosticating priest will go into a hat to win have a drawing to win this gift basket. So you want to give it a shot? Give it a try. I'll give you my final four a little bit later in the program. 573-4-BREAD-4 if you want to be on the show today. Call or text. You can send in your final four if you want to. 573-4-BREAD-4. Or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Later this hour, Tim Stanley, who is a historian and a journalist over in the United Kingdom, a Brit with his own particular political perspective, wrote a great column in the London Daily Telegraph the other day about Donald Trump and made a comparison from history, he being a historian and everything, with Donald Trump that I hadn't thought of before. And he does make the point that even though maybe some fascists are drawn to Donald Trump, Donald Trump really is not a fascist. So we'll talk to him about that, as well as an interesting perspective on the Salem witch craze back in the 1600s. And then in the second hour, my regular Thursday guest, Father Alan Carter for First Cup Theology, he's going to be on to talk a little bit about the scrutinies. Now, what are the scrutinies? The scrutinies are basically three rites, R-I-T-E-S, the third, fourth, and fifth Sundays during Lent. There are particular readings. You've got the woman at the well. You've got the healing of the man born blind, all from John's gospel, and the raising of Lazarus on Sundays 3, 4, and 5. And they're really, the scrutinies are intended to be really a period of self-examination for those who are preparing for baptism, for catechumens. Because if you haven't noticed in the Catholic Church, you know, baptism is something that we ask for preparation, particularly for someone who's an adult, which in the Catholic definition, liturgically speaking, sacramentally speaking, is anybody 7 years old and older. To really contemplate, what is it that I'm getting ready to do? And am I prepared for this life of discipleship to really surrender myself to what God through His grace wants to do in me? So we'll talk to Father Alan about that, and particularly on the themes of water, light, and life that have to do with the scrutinies. We'll give you the question of the day in the next segments. Other things we'll talk about, the politics of genocide, a key point in understanding hard Catholic teachings and wondering what the heck happened to Marco Rubio. All that and more in the show today, as well as spinning the Dalek Catechism wheel and giving out our What Were You Thinking awards and looking back in history, hopefully, if we get a chance. The first reading today, of course, we are getting closer and closer to Holy Week. This time next week, we'll be entering into the Triduum, the 3 days, Holy Thursday, Good Friday, into the Easter Vigil, which is Saturday evening. As I said yesterday, I want to go ahead and make a plug that if you've not been in the habit of being part of the Easter Triduum, of going to Holy Thursday Mass. And it is one liturgy, believe it or not, from Thursday through through the Easter Vigil. If you've never been a part of it before, then you want to do that. And I really encourage you to be a part of the Easter Vigil, to see those who enter into the life of the church, who enter into the baptismal waters. It's really a powerful experience, and you really get a sense of what the Easter mystery is all about. This event, Christ's life, death, resurrection, around which all of the church's life and our hope centers. Anyway, my PSA is done. Anyway, so back to the first reading, Genesis chapter 17, Abram's this developing covenant that he has with the Lord. At this point, as it tells us in Genesis 17, Abram is now 99 years old. Now, if you recall, God first appeared to Abram and made the promise of progeny when Abram was 75 years old. So we're now sitting 24 years later. If you recall, in the meantime, Abram had thought he would help God along with his promise, since the Lord seemed to be delayed. What's that old spiritual song? He's an on-time God. Yes, he is. He may not come when you want him to, but he'll always be on time. Abram, with the best of intentions, I would imagine, wanting to help God along with his promise, with the encouragement of his wife, Sarah, went in and slept with her maidservant, Hagar. Gotta love some of those female names in the Old Testament. Hagar, before he was a Viking, I guess she was Sarah's maidservant. Or Gomer, before he was a mechanic in Mayberry, he was Hosea's wife. But I digress. Anyway, so he goes in to sleep with Hagar, and of course has the son Ishmael, who ends up being cast out by Sarah. Human nature doesn't change. So I'm sure Sarah said to Abram before he went in to sleep with her maidservant, Abram probably said, "You sure you're okay with this?" And Sarah probably said, "It's fine." You know, fine is the code word for you better think twice, brother. Anyway, human nature doesn't change, and so all the conflict. So here we are now, 99. God still has not come through with his promise. Abram prostrated himself, and God spoke to him. "My covenant with you is this. You are to become the father of a host of nations. No longer shall you be called Abram. Your name shall be Abraham, for I'm making you the father of a host of nations. I will render you exceedingly fertile. I will make nations of you. Kings shall stem from you. I will maintain my covenant with you and your descendants after you throughout the ages as an everlasting pact. To be your God and the God of your descendants after you, I will give to you and to your descendants after you the land in which you're now staying, the whole land of Canaan, as a permanent possession, and I will be their God. God also said to Abraham, on your part, you and your descendants after you must keep my covenant throughout the ages." We'll come back to that, what Abraham's part of the deal was. But this whole word covenant, right, which is much more significant word than contract. Covenant is a promise in which you put your own character on the line. It is an unconditional promise, unlike a contract that is conditional depending on the other party's fulfillment of their obligation. A covenant is a promise without condition. This is why covenant is really a better word than contract for marriage. Even though the church has used that language in the past, marriage is a contract. There are certain obligations that come with marriage. Marriage, even more than a contract, is a covenant, which is more than an exchange of goods and services. It's actually an exchange of persons. And I've talked about this before, but it bears repeating, of what a mystery it is that God makes promises. We are, of course, helpless to know anything about God, infinite in majesty as he is, so beyond our comprehension. He has to condescend to us and to reveal himself to us. He does that through nature, through what we call natural revelation. There are certain things that we can deduce about God simply by observing this universe in which we live and the circumstances of life. even our own interior hunger for him. But there are mysteries of his identity and his nature and his character that we cannot know without his direct revelation. And covenants, in many ways, became vehicles of his revelation throughout Scripture. We learn things about God through his covenants. And even in the very fact that he makes covenants, God reveals something about himself. He is a God who makes promises. And as I never tire of saying, what a mystery it is that God makes promises simply because of who God is, what we believe about God. God is by nature omnipotent, all-powerful. Now, on an earthly realm, governments and all the rest, dictators, despots, they don't make promises because they don't have to. They've got all the power. To make promises puts yourself in a position of obligation, or somehow you're bound by something. Why would God, who is by definition all-powerful, make promises at all, let alone to a simple, humble man like Abram? Well, God makes promises for one reason, and really it's the same reason that we make promises. We make promises out of love. Love, by its very nature, makes promises. That's what the great British Christian G.K. Chesterton said. Love could never be free. Love binds itself. You don't have to tell lovers to make promises to each other. It comes with love. We'll unpack this more in the second hour. We'll be back in a minute. This is The Mike Allen Show. The hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show on this St. Patrick's Day. I'm asking the question of the day: what is your favorite Irish hymn, prayer, or blessing? Of course, Danny Boy there. Danny Boy among the more popular. In fact, it was mentioned on my show's Facebook page the most. And so if you want to chime in, you can call or text 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. Or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can always go on Facebook or on Twitter and post your comment as well. Certainly no shortage of great things to draw from. Of course, some hymns are simply Irish tunes, and then you got some interesting ones that are English lyrics set to Irish tunes, which is an interesting juxtaposition, as will me be having a British guest on the program on St. Patrick's Day. Of course, Patrick himself was British, we shouldn't forget. But developed, of course, a great love for the Irish people. And Patrick was quite a missionary as well, going into very hostile territory. We tend to forget that. The pagan religion, Druids, all the rest were par for the course there in Ireland, really at the beginning of Patrick's ministry. And he persevered in the midst of great danger and catechized, taught the faith continually. So, St. Patrick, pray for us. And if you want to chime in with your favorite Irish hymn, prayer, or blessing, you may do that. As I said, if you want to enter into our Bracketology with Father Bronner contest, you still have time. Go to the show's Facebook page, mikeallenshow.blogspot.com, and you can see the link to enter in and put your picks up against our prognosticating priest. If your picks are better than his, your name will go into a hat for a drawing to win this $100 valued Chick-fil-A gift basket. Looking at the games last night, if you'll recall, Tuesday night's games in the first round, I'm no longer calling it the play-in games out of respect for my Michigan fan friend, Brian. But the first round games, of course, Tuesday night were both blowouts, big wins by Wichita State and Florida Gulf Coast. Last night, much more close. I didn't watch either one of them. I had to go to bed. I'm already trying to figure out how I'm going to stay up tonight and watch a game that'll probably end around midnight. Let me just say this to my Wildcats, because I'm sure a lot of them listening to this program up early. You better bring home a win, because I don't want to stay up to midnight and be back in here at 6 a.m. after a loss. Let's just put it that way. Even though everybody's picking Stony Brook in this sort of, it's the popular upset pick right now. No chance. We'll take care of business. Let's see. Holy Cross winning last night, a close one over Southern. And Michigan beating Tulsa. So my friend Brian, who went up to Dayton, which, from what I understand, is really a great venue for these first round games. Nice arena there. The people in Dayton, Ohio, really know their basketball and come out. So I'm sure he had a lot of fun there last night, and I'm sure got back late. That's the thing. I'm kind of getting old now, wimping out on the hour. I remember when I think it was back in 95, so I would have been, 28 years old, not quite 29. On a whim, I was living in Myrtle Beach at the time, hopped in the car, picked up a friend of mine at another town in South Carolina, and drove to Athens, Georgia for an 8 p.m. Kentucky-Georgia game in Stegman Coliseum, and then left after the game to drive the 5 hours back. I think arrived back at my house in Myrtle Beach at 4 a.m. You may be wondering, Mike, why would you have ever moved away from Myrtle Beach? Don't bring up a sore subject. 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. I'm looking at the bracket here. I still haven't filled out my picks yet. I'll have to do that here in the next couple of hours once the show is done. As I said yesterday, that Colorado-UConn game should be a good one. I think Kansas better lace them up in the second round against the winner of that game. I'm going to pick Temple to beat Iowa. I just can't go with Iowa. Considering how they struggled down the stretch, seemed to be a shell of themselves. I believe St. Joe's will beat Cincinnati. That's the 8-9 game. And I think St. Joe's will give Oregon all they want. Let's see other potential upsets. Look out for Green Bay over Texas A&M. That could be it. I'm not sure I'll pull the trigger on that one, but that's one that makes me a little bit nervous. Let's see. Michigan State better be ready in round two when they play Dayton. And another game that I think will be an interesting one is this Texas Tech-Butler game. Tubby Smith, who back in the tournament after a hiatus, I think he went once when he was at Minnesota. I think he lost his only first-round game with the Golden Gophers. But Tubby seems to be typically a pretty strong first-round, or let's say we say second-round NCAA tournament coach. I look for Texas Tech to pull the win there, not to beat Virginia, though. And then keep an eye on that Chattanooga-Indiana game, which could be very interesting. I don't know which of those games are on Thursday and Friday. I know the Indiana game is today. So a lot to unfold over the next couple of days for sure. Real Clear Sports doing us all a favor with an article, Top 10 Players to Watch in the 2016 Tournament. They mentioned Domantas Sabonis for Gonzaga. We'll see how long Gonzaga can stick around. He's, of course, the son of Arvydas Sabonis, the former Soviet-Lithuanian great who dominated for those great Russian teams in the Olympics for so many years. Rico Gathers, with a name like Rico, how can you not love him, for Baylor. Thomas Walkup for Stephen F. Austin. Let's see, Jacob Poeltl for Utah. And let's see, Utah back after a little hiatus. Georges Niang from Iowa State. Gary Payton II from Oregon State. Son of the glove, I guess. Let's see, number Grayson Allen Duke, no thank you. Yeah, watch your feet when you're playing Grayson Allen of Duke. Denzel Valentine, Michigan State. Jameel Warney, Stony Brook, thank you very much. Just made me sweat even more. Buddy Hield, Oklahoma. And that was number one there. Yeah, Buddy can shoot the lights out when he's on. Look out. Another strange sports story yesterday had to do with baseball and a conflict with the Chicago White Sox. And that is basically making Adam LaRoche, the White Sox player, prematurely retire. Now, yesterday we talked about B.J. Raji, the defensive lineman for the Green Bay Packers, retiring in heroic fashion to care for his mother and his aunt, who are both very, very ill, and he's lost a little bit of his passion for the game. But evidently, Adam LaRoche is retiring from the White Sox because the White Sox banned his 14-year-old son from their clubhouse. And as Ken Rosenthal writes this at FoxSports.com, when he first heard the story, Rosenthal says he thought, A, he was crazy to walk away from $13 million over such an issue. That was what his contract was due to pay him. And B, that the White Sox were crazy to make an issue of it at all. He said, after speaking with Major League sources who explained LaRoche's thinking, I gained a better understanding over why he would make such a decision. His son, Drake, 14, has been his constant companion for years. After speaking with White Sox president Ken Williams, who asked LaRoche to dial it back on the amount of time that Drake spent with the team, I gained a better understanding of the team's thinking as well, but not a complete understanding, Rosenthal says. Would Williams have raised the issue if LaRoche was coming off a big offensive season instead of a subpar one, which he had this past year? Don't think so. But why did Williams raise the issue in the middle of an upbeat camp with the Sox preparing to compete in the hotly contested AL Central rather than establish a new policy before the players even arrived? Williams said the team didn't change its policy, but acknowledged that he did ask LaRoche not to bring Drake to the park 100% of the time as he had in the past, or even 50% of the time. Williams asked, "You tell me, where in this country can you bring your child to work every day?" Okay, Mr. Williams, but where else in this country can you wear a ball cap and cleats to work every day? Come on, really? This is the biggest problem you've got to deal with. It's hard for me to have a lot of sympathy for the White Sox in this situation, I have to say, because by all accounts, everybody loved the kid and none of the players had a problem with it. So I don't know. We'll see how this story unfolds. Real quick, want to sneak in some What Were You Thinkings. We're going to do NCAA Tournament What Were You Thinkings. And I'm going to give you three really quick. Fred Brown, 1982, Georgetown versus North Carolina. Georgetown a chance to win it after Michael Jordan's shot gives them the lead. Fred Brown throws the ball to James Worthy. Secondly, Chris Webber's timeout. 1993 against UNC when there was no timeout to be had. But number three, and my coach John Calipari brought this up yesterday, Rick Pitino, 1992, put somebody on the inbounds pass. What were you thinking? We'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show. No stars in the black night. Looks like the sky fell down. No sun in the daylight. Looks like it. Shame to the ground, shame to the ground. The warning sent, the exit sold. If you want a way out, shoot the rain. We're right at the bottom of the hour. This is the Mike Allen Show. Come on St. Patrick's Day. You know I got to play some U2 bumper music. This from Rattle and Hum, my all-time favorite U2 song, Silver and Gold. What I love about it a little bit later is Bono decides he's going to do some preaching, which he does. Follow with that great line, am I bugging you? Don't mean to bug you. Okay, Edge, play the blues. 573-4-BREAD-4. Hope you're doing well this morning. I had the breakfast of champions today. Two Pop-Tarts and a cup of coffee. My wife bought Pop-Tarts. I was a happy, happy man. And when it comes to Pop-Tarts, it begins and ends with brown sugar cinnamon. Don't be calling up with your blueberry, your s'mores, or anything like that. It all starts with brown sugar cinnamon. Cold right out of the foil. 573-4-BREAD-4. If you want to call, what is your favorite Irish hymn, prayer, or blessing? That's the question of the day here on St. Patrick's Day. You can call or text 573-4-BREAD-4, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com, or post your response on Facebook or on Twitter. A couple of comments we've gotten. Jill says, be thou my vision. Oh, yeah. That is a very favorite hymn in the Allen household. Kathy says, may the road rise to meet you, and I danced in the morning. Laura says, Danny Boy, actually her favorite priest, Father Norman, singing Danny Boy at a funeral. And Mark, who is a seminarian, who was our Oscars reviewer a couple of weeks ago, Mark says, may your soul already be in heaven an hour before the devil knows you're dead, if only because it inspired the name of a Sidney Lumet film. So give me a shout on that, 573-4-BREAD-4, or email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. And as I said, if you still want to enter the Bracketology with Father Bronner contest, just go to the show's blog, mikeallenshow.blogspot.com, mikeallenshow.blogspot.com, and you can follow the links and prompts on how to do it. Interesting article in the Federalist that I came across yesterday, the end for Marco Rubio. Of course, Marco Rubio suspending his campaign after losing his home state. By the way, I put a call into my good friend Jason Hall, who's a regular guest on the program, yesterday, because I had a question about the Republican nomination process. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, there is a chance that Donald Trump, even though he has a big lead, will not get to the requisite number of delegates. I think he has to have just over 50% of the delegates to pretty much seal up the nomination. And to seal up the nomination for the Republicans. And if not, then we'll have a brokered convention or contested convention. Well, I kept hearing that term. I even said it myself, a little bit like if you ever saw that episode of Seinfeld where Jerry challenged Kramer because Kramer kept talking about a write-off for the insurance company, and Jerry said, you don't even know what a write-off is. Well, I think I was doing that with contested convention. I didn't even know what the heck I was talking about. So I called my friend Jason and said, what's the process? And he said, it's like this. Look, all the delegates are basically obligated to vote for the candidate that they are assigned to. But for all of them, that only goes on the first ballot. So they take the first ballot at the convention. If nobody gets over 50% of the delegates, then it goes to a second ballot. And in the second ballot, in some states, delegates are then free to vote for whoever they want. And usually by the third or the fourth vote from the floor, all the delegates are free to vote for whoever they want. So it's almost like another little mini campaign at the convention. And so there's all kind of things that could happen. What he thinks could happen is if there is no clear winner after the last primary in about, I don't know, I think you've got maybe about 5 or 6 weeks before the convention there later in July, that you may see some sort of new candidacy emerge. Maybe a Romney Kasich ticket, for example. So it all comes down to whether or not the Donald, because it doesn't seem like there's a path for anybody else to get the majority delegates between now and then, unless there's some huge scandal that breaks with Donald Trump, which will probably be Donald Trump, which will probably only boost his poll numbers. But that's going to be the thing to watch, is can he get the requisite, however many, 1,200 and something delegates he needs to seal it up before the convention? Trump coming out with a comment yesterday that if there is a contested convention, there could be violence. See, I don't like that. That's like he can you know, it's plausible deniability that he is inciting violence. What could I do? There just may be violence. Come on, Donald. Anyway, but I came across this article in The Federalist about Marco Rubio. And, you know, there was such hope for Marco Rubio. I think it was after New Hampshire. It wasn't after. I guess it was maybe before New Hampshire. He had a bad debate. And things just kind of seemed to go downhill from there. He bounced back a little bit in South Carolina. But as I've talked about before, I think Marco Rubio's demise came when he decided to get down in the mud and duke it out with Donald Trump, where Donald Trump is far more skilled and experienced. And Rubio, I think, whether he would have had a chance anyway, I doubt. But I don't think he helped himself at all. But I think it's a very balanced piece here in The Federalist, which is certainly a conservative-leaning publication. But it says, the end for Marco Rubio, the failure of Rubio's campaign seems more and more to be a failure of the people Rubio chose to surround himself with, as opposed to a failure of the candidate himself. Well, I don't know that you can subdivide that out quite so much. But he observes, Ben Dominic, who has written this piece, just as others have observed, that Rubio's demise really in many ways signals the demise of Bush conservatism, because Rubio was trying to essentially, just like George's brother Jeb, trying to repackage this brand of conservatism, this sort of neocon approach that is just did not gain traction for whatever reason. It also talks a little bit about how poor of a ground game Marco Rubio had, which in my opinion reflects back on the guy at the top. I don't see how it can not do that. And that is one thing where I think you have to tip your hat to Ted Cruz. In terms of organizing and running a campaign, he has done an excellent job. It's not going to get him the nomination, probably, maybe, but it certainly has gotten him into a position where he is the only real credible threat at this point, it seems like, to Donald Trump. Another interesting, I want to get into this in the next hour, this whole question of genocide and the American government. There's some controversy. There is a certain politics of genocide. As you know, the U.S. House voted 393-0 this past Monday night that the Islamic State's assaults on religious minorities in Iraq and Syria constitute genocide, which is a rare designation that advocates hope will drive attention and action to the plight of the persecuted groups. I mean, if you can get the U.S. House to vote 393-0 on something, it's worth paying attention to. And so now the question is, will the White House corroborate? Will the White House come alongside? Will John Kerry come alongside? Indications seem to indicate it's likely that they will. But don't be fooled. I mean, there's a politics to genocide because of when you begin to use that language, then it begins to at least morally obligate persons and leaders in a country to do something about it, perhaps. So we'll watch and see how that unfolds. Unfortunately, it seems like it can be open game, open season on Christians in a way that's much more tolerable for government officials here than other religious groups. Just saying. All right, let's look back on history for just a minute, because we've got a couple of things from this day, March 17th, over the ages.
Where are we, dude?
These are the circuits of history, gentlemen. They'll take us to any point in time we wish.
Where are we?
Gentlemen, we're history.
Don't know much about history.
All right, so on this day in 432, traditionally, St. Patrick, age 16, is carried off to Ireland as a slave. Interesting that he would come back. Yesterday I was sharing with my class the account of the martyrdom of Saint Jean de Brébeuf, the French Jesuit priest who was killed by the Iroquois back in the 1600s, yesterday the anniversary of his death. Of course, Brébeuf had been captured, had been brutalized by the Iroquois, had had his first finger and thumb cut off to keep him from celebrating the Mass, allegedly, was able to escape and get back to France. But somehow he went back. Same thing happened with St. Patrick. He escaped slavery and then decided to go back as a bishop and as a missionary to Ireland. No wonder he's beloved. On 1755, on this day, the Transylvania Land Company buys Kentucky for $50,000 from a Cherokee chief. My home state. 1902, Bobby Jones was born. One of those athletes from the past that if I could go back in time and watch, I'd love to see Bobby Jones hit a golf ball. Just I'd love to see Sammy Baugh, born on this day in 1914, throw a football. That'd be a good question of the day sometime. Which athlete would you go back in time to watch in the flesh? Maybe the Babe? Maybe Lou Gehrig? Who knows? Born on this day in 1951, Kurt Russell. That'd be another interesting question. Your favorite Kurt Russell movie? I'll probably start with Miracle, his great portrayal of Herb Brooks, and then go to Tombstone. Hell's coming with me. We'll be back. We'll talk to Tim Stanley from Over the Pond about Donald Trump. This is the Mike Allen Show. Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. Again, our question of the day on this St. Patrick's Day: what is your favorite Irish hymn, prayer, or blessing? Love to hear your thoughts on that. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. If you want to call in about anything else, we mentioned Kurt Russell's birthday. You want to call in and tell me your favorite Kurt Russell movie. He's had some good ones over the years, no doubt. Snake Plissken, I thought you were dead. Give us a shout. We're efforting Tim Stanley, my friend over from across the pond, who is a historian and a journalist, writes for the London Daily Telegraph, among others, also regularly featured on CNN. He is someone with a unique perspective on American politics and on Donald Trump, and makes the argument that Donald Trump, despite the fact that there are fascists who are attracted to his campaign, that Donald Trump himself is not a fascist. And he makes the comparison to another populist political figure who preyed upon sometimes our the worst angels of our nature back in the late 60s, early 70s. But if we were able to get in touch with him, hopefully we'll be able to get him on. Like I said, perfectly appropriate that we have a Brit on for St. Patrick's Day, given that St. Patrick himself was a Brit, as I'm sure the Brits never tire of reminding their friends there in one island over. Anyway, love to hear from you. As I said, if you want to enter the Bracketology with Father Bronner contest, have a shot at winning our $100 gift basket from our friends at Chick-fil-A with all kind of gift cards for free meals, a free catering tray, free milkshakes, all the rest, also different Chick-fil-A paraphernalia, including a small little stuffed animal cow with an Eat More Chicken banner on the side. All you got to do is go to the show's blog, mikeallenshow.blogspot.com, mikeallenshow.blogspot.com, for more information on how you can get signed up. You got till noon today. Noon today. You know, I was talking yesterday about my experience Tuesday night. I finished up the second part of my marriage preparation course for engaged couples. We use a curriculum that was put together by a company called Ascension Press that's rooted in the teaching of Pope St. John Paul II called the Theology of the Body. It's really based on talks that the late Pope gave, 129 of them from 1979 to 1984. Really quite phenomenal. It is deep stuff, profound stuff, but the kind of stuff that is so dense that it provokes so much thought that as you begin to contemplate this vision of the human being and the human person and the fact that God made us with bodies, our bodies intrinsically part of who we are, but he also made us, as the Genesis creation account tells us, he made us in his image, male and female, he created them, that somehow in the very structure of our embodiment as man and woman, our bodies bear within themselves a marital language. They speak of union. And it's in that communion of love expressed in one way through the union of two in one flesh in marriage that images who God is a communion of persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And that this understanding of our bodies and the nature of this self-giving love to which we're called, because our bodies tell us we are incomplete in ourselves, we were made for love, to give ourselves away for love, and that our bodies point to the fact that we were made for marriage. Ultimately, the marriage we're made for is the marriage with God for all eternity. That's why Christ came as a bridegroom to rescue his bride, the church. It's why he gives his body to us in the Eucharist, in the consummation of that great divine love, in receiving his body, a gift, body, blood, soul, and divinity. So we unpack this vision for engaged couples to help them understand exactly what marriage is, that it's not just simply some social arrangement to give one tax benefits, but it's actually a participation in the mystery of God's salvation, his grace, his redemption. It becomes a sign, of course, not only of who God is, but of Christ's great love for his church. St. Paul talks about that in Ephesians 5. And of course, we spend the first week kind of laying this vision, because having a proper vision is really what should drive you and keep you on this marital journey, even when it gets difficult. The second half, we talk about what are the implications for that. What does it mean, then, to live in the truth about our sexuality and who we are and what married love is? How do we live in the truth about that? And invariably, we begin to talk about some difficult moral issues, some difficult moral teachings of the Catholic Church that not only do some outside the church reject, maybe many, but even there are plenty of Catholics inside the church who reject these things. For example, the idea that sex by its very nature has a marital language. It is a marital gift by its very nature. Therefore, two unmarried persons cannot have honest sex. Doesn't mean they won't find some intimacy in it, some pleasure, sense of temporal happiness, but at an objective, foundational level, it's a dishonest act because we're saying something with our bodies that is not true. Therefore, we try to speak less of sexual morality as in a list of rules as to say, what's the truth and how can we speak the truth with our bodies? Of course, we also get into the very difficult teaching of regarding contraception. And if the sexual union, if this one flesh gift is what consummates, you know, consummate is a word that is not just a euphemism for sex, as if we're embarrassed to say sex. You know, did you consummate the relationship? No, consummate means to sum up, to perfect, and to complete. Think of it in basketball terms, which we all do, of course. Last year, I was hoping this time of year that Kentucky would consummate a perfect season. 40-0 with a national championship, of course, it was not to be. But to consummate means to sum up, perfect, complete. It's the sexual union that consummates, sums up, perfects, and completes the promises made at the altar, the promise to love as God loves, without reservation, without condition, and without end. Therefore, an act of contraception or sterilization, that which would intentionally seek to detach fertility from the act, is a reduction by its very nature of the act. It is no longer a total gift. And some barrier, whether physical or chemical, is placed between the couple. It is not truly a marital union. And this is the reason why, in the Catholic vision, the belief is that for an act of sexual intercourse to be a truly marital act, it must be open to life. Well, as you know, there are many who reject that teaching. Many Catholics reject that teaching. Some do it out of fear. They're not quite sure that God can be trusted with, you know, that they're not convinced that there are means such as periodic abstinence with which one can properly steward one's fertility. But here's where we have to, and I was telling the couples this the other night, when it comes to a difficult moral teaching in the church, the key is we need to try to understand it in light of what we already know about Catholic teaching and to push past sort of the ridiculous straw man. And understand, okay, even if I disagree with this teaching, can I at least understand why this teaching is what it is. Because what you'll hear in the culture are things like, well, the reason the church is against contraception is because they just want people having more Catholics. What we know about Catholic teaching actually is, and there's plenty of evidence for this everywhere, Catholic faith actually strongly affirms the obligation that people have to properly steward their fertility and responsible parenthood. Read the 1968 letter Humanae Vitae from Pope Paul VI. He says that very thing. It's not this false dichotomy between have as many babies as possible or use contraception and sterilization. It's actually responsible stewardship, but in ways that don't distort the meaning of the sexual act. So you can eliminate that. That's not a reason. Or people will say things like, yeah, you know why the Catholic Church is against contraception? I don't know why I'm talking like this, but anyway. You know why the Catholic Church is against contraception? It's because they want more babies so that they can get more money. Well, listen, I'm the father of seven. I give a lot less to the church as a father of seven than I would if I was a father of two, okay? And given the rate at which young people are falling away from practicing of the faith, I think we can eliminate that very cynical viewpoint as the reason. Now, you can rest assured that if there is a moral teaching of the Catholic Church that you don't understand, that there is a very rational reason within the integrity of the church's whole teaching of why the church teaches that. I'm not saying you have to agree with it. My goodness, you're a free person. I'm a free person with all the privilege and responsibility that comes with that. But if you're going to reject something, at least make sure you understand what you're rejecting. It's easy to reject a caricature. I mean, if the reason sometimes that people attributed to certain Catholic teachings were the actual reason, I'd reject them myself. But here's the thing, and it's actually what drew me to the Catholic Church was when I began to see how comprehensively integrated all of Catholic teaching is. It's amazing. We've been thinking about this stuff for 2,000 years. Now, I'm not saying the teachings aren't hard. You better believe they're hard. And increasingly difficult in a culture that is largely opposed to them. But you can rest assured there's a reason behind it. Just like the church's, for example, opposition to the idea that marriage is possible between two members of the same gender. That's not a Catholic teaching because the Catholic Church hates homosexual people. It's because of what the church believes about the nature of marriage itself. That's the question. Don't be satisfied with caricatures, please. Understand and grow. We'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show with a new hour.